This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Samir El-Youssef, was born in 1965 in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. He was exposed to a lot of radical rhetoric about martyrdom, but what he responded to was literature. He's now a writer living in London. Last year, the Swedish chapter of PEN, the International Writers' Organization, awarded him the Tucholsky Award, which is for writers who are persecuted or living in exile. In 2004, he co-authored the short story collection Gaza Blues with the Israeli writer Edgar Keret, who we just heard from. El-Youssef's mother lives in Lebanon, and some of his relatives there have had to flee from Israeli bombing. I spoke with him yesterday and asked him first about his view of the war.
What this war actually reminds me is it reminds me of 1994, just after the Oslo Agreement, in which the Hamas and the al-Jihad in Gaza and the West Bank vowed to sort of bury the peace process, as they said at the time. And basically that's what they went about to do by basically sort of launching a campaign of suicide bombing against Israel. The thing is, Israel, in its usual reaction of being an overreaction, an excessive reaction, somehow accommodated the Hamas people by sort of responding to their desire to destroy the peace process, which more or less what happened in the years that followed. What we see here is somehow similar. We have a country that's trying to rebuild itself, Lebanon, with its different confessions and groups who are trying to live with each other peacefully, or with some with a degree of peace, in which no group or no confession can sort of impose its own will on the other groups, Shiite, Sunni, Christian, Maronite, Orthodox, etc. And there it is, Hezbollah, who believes in violence, who believes in the continuation of state of war, targets Israel in this manner, and Israel response by sort of accommodating its desire to create a state of war and state of violence in Lebanon. Unfortunately, we have basically people like Hamas and Hezbollah and al-Jihad, groups who do not believe in peace, groups who have an agenda for war and violence. They are very coherent, very, in a sense, brutally honest about it. They've never said anything otherwise. On the other hand, we have Israel, who is always willing to sort of accommodate these people and responding to their desires. Somehow I feel like, there's a, it's just as if rebuilding, living in peace is just sort of, is something that's, it's not going to happen, not only because of one group that doesn't want. It's like just on both sides, there are sort of a certain desire or willingness to destroy any attempt to rebuild and to live in peace.
Now, you grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon, and so you came of age with a lot of militant Palestinians, and I'm wondering what the rhetoric was like when you were a teenager.
Well, the public was lots of sloganization, lots of slogans and mottos about liberating our country, about the resistance, about our right to return, about fighting imperialism and fighting Zionism and fighting this and fighting that. This was a sort of, overwhelming rhetoric within the camp and within Lebanon in general in the 70s, wherever there was sort of, a PLO influence or the left-wing Lebanese political parties. This was a kind of rhetoric that was dominant. For me and for other writers, especially for my generation, we had to fight our way through in order to sort of not to succumb to this kind of hollow rhetoric of sloganization, of resistance and fighting, imperialism and fighting this and fighting that. The great help was, of course, from literature, from international writings, but also from private experiences, from the sort of, popular way of expressing themselves, of how folks, how ordinary people, talk about things, and that was very helpful in this attempt to find a different language from the rather sort of rhetorical political language that was dominant at the time.
In your novella, The Day the Beast Got Thirsty, you have a character named Ahmed, who is a militant within the Palestinian refugee camp, and the main character says, "I liked listening to Ahmed, especially after I had a couple of joints, but sometimes Ahmed used to say things that made me realize that unless I leave the country, I shall go mad." What kind of things did you hear that made you feel like you would go mad?
Well, I think he goes on. I think the character of the novella goes on to say that, you know, Ahmed at one time tells him, like, you know, they're going to be a war, you know, and after that war, everything will be all right. So he tells him, for how long this war going to go on? He's telling him, well, it's about 20, 30 years. So, I mean, you know, that's what would drive you mad. If somebody tells you that we're going to have peace, but only first we're going to have a long war of 20 or 30 years, I don't think you want to hang around waiting for that war to end. The reference to madness basically is the idea that the absurdity of the situation in the Lebanon, especially at the time that the novella takes place, which is towards the end of the 80s. And a great deal of the expressions, they don't mean what they say. You know, the narrator starts with this sentence, I like listening to Ahmed, and it goes on and on all through the novella. But, you know, by the end of it, you don't know whether he really likes to listen to Ahmed or not. It's just somebody saying something that's to express, you know how bad things are, because what Ahmed says is just basically makes him, you know, angry, makes him laugh, you know, it's just a sort of thing that, you know, you don't want really to hear in a sense.
Let me quote something that gives a sense of the ironic tone of your novel, and this is the main character thinking. Ironically, yes, I thought to myself, we must get married, Dalal and I. We will get married and have 10 children. But then they will die and have their photos as huge posters glued to the walls of the camp, declaring them as heroic martyrs who have died while fighting the Zionist enemy. And Dalal and I would be the proudest parents of 10 martyrs. After that, Israel could invade Lebanon again, destroy our camp, mess us all up, so we die and get the hell out of this life. And I just say I took a couple of liberties, changing a couple of the of the words, yes, that we can't say on the radio. So did you have friends who wanted their children to grow up to be martyrs?
Certainly not. I can't recall anybody. I don't remember anybody who wanted his children to be martyrs, or they wanted to be martyrs. Not at all. Especially at that time of the of our lives, I don't think anybody believed in martyrdom. In the contrary, I mean, the whole point of this passage, this expression, is to make fun of the whole idea of martyrdom, you know, that the children are going to be killed by whatever it is, you know. I mean, at one point in the novella, there is a sort of a dispute, a fight, a battle between local militias and local parties. And the people who are killed in this battle are called martyrs. So it's in a sense to show the hollowness of this expression of martyrdom, of how easy, of how simple to consider anybody who died, you know, in any kind of absurd fight or clash between local militias, to consider him as a martyr. One of the reasons of writing about it in this manner is actually to sort of, you know, to expose this kind of rhetoric for what it is. You know, this idea about the heroic martyrs who are fighting the Zionist enemy, when they are not fighting the Zionist enemy, and they are not heroic, and they certainly are not martyrs. But it's just sort of to just take this concept and show it how hollow it is and how meaningless it is, and strip it from all the sort of, you know, from all the ideology that supports it and glorify it.
As a Palestinian refugee in Lebanon, did you have the rights of a citizen in Lebanon?
No, certainly not. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been a refugee. Well, I mean, part of the problem of refugee is not only what is the war of 1948. You're going to find a lot of people who are just going to talk about Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and in Jordan and Syria. And there are a lot of them, they demand the right to return and things like that. There is an attempt to use this issue. I mean, there is an issue. There is a problem on the ground, basically. It's called the refugee problems, and it is in Lebanon, it's in Jordan, it's in Syria, where a huge number of Palestinians are still living in refugee camps without any political or civil rights, great deal of them. I mean, in a country like Lebanon, there are dozens and dozens of jobs and that Palestinians are not allowed to practice. Palestinians are not allowed to benefit from any kind of the public sector. They are not allowed to be employed by the public sector, by the Lebanese public sector. They are not allowed to go to schools or hospitals in Lebanon. So this is after 60 years of living there. So it's a problem that has, you know, there's more than one, you know, responsible party for it. Basically starts with Israel, but then it goes on to include the Lebanese government, the Jordanian government, the Arab countries in general, who are not sort of, you know, helping to sort of to solve this problem, and of course the PLO, who for a long time used the refugee camps in order to promote their own kind of politics.
What year did you leave Lebanon?
I left Lebanon in 1999, at the end of 1989. I left and went to Cyprus and stayed for a year there and worked there. And then having acquired residence permit in Cyprus, I was lucky enough to get a visa to come to England.
Which is where you live now.
Yes.
My guest is Samir El Youssef. He's a writer who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is essayist and fiction writer Samir El Youssef. He grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon and now lives in London. How are you exposed to literature?
It's strange. I grew up in a house which where there were no books whatsoever apart from the Quran. The Quran, which was not read because my parents are illiterate, or my father and my mother didn't read. And by and large, people around me didn't read. People only read books that were meant to be read at school and for education. I don't know. It was part of this yearning for something else, I suppose. It was this desire. I've always had this imagination, the sense that there is something beyond, something greater, something bigger and larger and more complicated and richer than the one we had. And I suppose I came about to books through this sort of, this yearning, this imagination that led me to feel there must be something else, and books, I suppose, like films, like photos, like so many things that sort of were one way of trying to sort of satisfy this yearning for the world that lies beyond.
What were some of the books that made the biggest impression on you?
Well, I mean, basically, the Egyptian writer Najib Mahfouz was one of the greatest influence. In his style, the way he constructs his narrative, the tales that he tells, the world of Cairo in the 30s and the 40s, somehow. And within the Arab world, Cairo was a sort of different place, a richer place, a greater place, more complicated. So many things. There is poverty, but there's certain charm to this kind of poverty. This is a sort of a poverty of a more traditional setting. Somebody who lives in a refugee camp can identify with. I mean, unlike the Lebanese capital, Beirut, which was very luxurious, very sort of. Push in a sense, it was very hard. You could, with Beirut, you feel there is really a difference. There is a huge gap between you and Beirut, but with Cairo was something else for somebody who lived in a refugee camp.
Growing up in Lebanon during the civil war and the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, and growing up in a Palestinian refugee camp where I imagine there was a lot of just petty crime too, as there is in a lot of poor neighborhoods. Did you grow up with a sense of constant fear, or were you just so used to it that didn't even get to you?
The fear and danger came from politics more than anything else, not from the social life there. I mean, this is one of the amazing things about lives, the time I'm describing or I'm talking about, that is the early 70s, the late 60s and early 70s. One thing about the Palestinian refugees in the camps, they somehow behaved themselves. You would hardly hear about any kind of incident. I mean, there were sort of trouble between families, some kind of feud, some old feuds and conflicts of this sort. But theft, murder, I mean, all these sort of things, it wasn't something common. I mean, it's so rare. I mean, it's unbelievable. And it's not because there was a good police or good policing or good belief in law and order. It's just there was this sort of, Palestinians managed after all these years, after they left their communities back in Palestine and transferred it to Lebanon. They lived within the moral code of a traditional society, where just sort of there are families where people respect, where the young respect the old, and people respect their borders and everything. So it was a kind of, they managed to sort of maintain this sort of life. The only danger really that we were worried about, it was the one came from the conflict, the clashes between the PLO and Israel.
When you meet Palestinians who grew up in the Gaza or the West Bank, and you compare experiences, what are some of the most similar and different things about your experience and theirs?
What I notice usually is the difference rather than the similarities. I mean, for people who lived in the in the occupied territories, especially particularly refugees in Gaza and the West Bank, the only people the only sort of aggressive or dominant force is the Israelis. For us in Lebanon, it was more than just the Israelis. The Israelis, the Syrians, Lebanese, sometimes the Palestinians themselves, the PLO, for example. So it's always sort of, a sense of there's something different. I mean, we assume that we are alike, but then once we start sort of dealing with our problems, expressing our concerns, expressing our political views and ideas, you realize that there are quite a few differences between both of us, between people in the West Bank and Gaza and Lebanon.
No, I'm wondering if that helped shape your attitude toward the Israelis in the sense that the Israelis weren't the only group that you might see as your enemy, because there were other people who were a danger to Palestinian refugees. There were other groups.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think you mentioned 1982. I wasn't really that much frightened. I mean, I know that the Israelis went for full-scale war against the PLO in Lebanon, and quite a few thousand people were arrested and imprisoned in Ansar in South Lebanon. I don't think I was at any time as frightened as later on when the War of the Camps, for example, with a sort of Lebanese militia attacking Palestinians. I was more frightened then than from the Israelis. I'm not saying that the Israelis were very nice and friendly. They were not. But what I'm saying that they were, in a sense, you felt less in danger than you with the militia, with a sort of Lebanese militia that who were acting out of sheer hatred sometimes. So it was that, and you are absolutely right. This awareness, I mean, for me, if you would have asked me at that time if you're going to be arrested or captured by anybody, by the Israelis or the Syrians or the Lebanese militia, which one would you want to be arrested with? I would say the Israelis right away. I would know what would happen to me with the Israelis. I'm not sure that I know what would happen to me with the Syrians or with the Lebanese militias. I'm not saying this to praise the Israelis, but I'm to say how bad things were and why, in a sense, I grew up to believe that we are not just facing, it's not a question of two sides fighting one another. We are more than one side. There are more than two sides. There are plenty of sides there, and everybody's fighting everybody. And the idea for peace and the whole project of peace must address all these issues, all these sides, not to just say it's just a question of Arabs against Israelis or Palestinians against Israelis. There is more to it than just that. And there are certain times in which an Arab side might be more dangerous to another Arab side than the Israelis. And it in more than one occasion it happened that way.
Yeah, well, I can't help but wonder how growing up in an atmosphere with a lot of hate, because it was a civil war, it was a period of occupation, and the way you're describing it, a lot of different groups preyed on Palestinians. How do you grow up in a climate of hate and distrust like that and emerge without being a hater yourself?
I don't know. I just think that I think that there is a human will. There is the human will plays a great deal of it. I mean, and in a sense of awareness of more than one of existing of more than one side to it, of more than one dimension of more. I mean, the sense that Jews are not sort of aliens coming from another planet, some kind of sinister aliens coming from another planet. The awareness that there's life, that there's society there, that there are people, that there are parents, that they are professionals, that people grow up, wake up in the morning because they're thinking about their social problems, about how to earn money. They're not thinking about going and killing Palestinians. They're thinking about, surviving, in their daily lives. But it does help a great deal to sort of realize, starting from yourself, what is worrying you. I mean, at an early age, I realized it is not destroying the Israelis or killing the Israelis is what really concerns us most. It's what concerns us, how to get out of this awful life in the refugee camp, how to get education and to get out of it and have a sort of peaceful life somewhere else. That's what we are worried about, not fighting somebody, fighting the enemy, as public and nationalist rhetoric went around. So it's this kind, if you reflect on that, if you sort of reflect on what's been happening, it wouldn't be very hard to sort of, you know, overcome the sentiment of hate. And by and large, I grew up within an environment which did not appreciate the whole idea of this sentiment of hatred. I don't think in my surroundings there been ever somebody who really hated the Israeli, like hate that I really wish them harm. There was a sense that they are basically our enemies, but it's sort of, it wasn't hate. It was like, you know, all right, we had a fight with them. They are our enemies. We're still at war with them. And basically, it's too long a conflict to keep hating. It's just, you can't keep hating.
My guest is Samir El Youssef. He's a writer who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is essayist and fiction writer Samir El Youssef. He grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon and now lives in London. Do you expect to see a Palestinian state in your lifetime?
No.
Really?
No, I don't think so. Oh, well, I mean, at best it's going to be a failed Palestinian state.
Why a failed state?
Well, can't you see? Can't you see what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank and the West Bank? So I don't think it's going to be a peaceful Palestinian state.
Do you feel like you've found a real home in London?
No, I can't say that. I mean, London is very comfortable. London has been very generous for me and for people like me. It's a great place to be. It's great. I've been really very lucky to live the last 15 or 16 years of my life in London. I've learned so much. It's been really a great thing to be in London and all this time, and to benefit from it in terms of education, in terms of work, in terms of friendship and knowledge. It's great. It's a great place, but I can't call it home.
What do you call home?
I don't really know. I don't know what home is, to be honest. I was born in a refugee camp. Once you are born in a refugee camp, you don't know the meaning of the word home. Being too pretentious here, sort of, you know, metaphysical homeless, I suppose, or something like that.
Metaphysically homeless?
Yeah. I mean, basically, I do not have idea what a home is supposed to mean. I mean, you know, I very much cherish a saying by the German Jewish philosopher, Theodor Adorno, who says that the highest form of morality is not to feel at home, even when you are at home.
Just one last thing. It seems to me that your sense of wanting a peaceful resolution to the Palestinian refugees and to the Middle East wars is somehow connected to your love of literature. I'm not saying that your love of literature led to your interest in peace, but they're both connected to the same impulse, which has to do with having a sense of empathy for other people and being able to stand back and seeing a kind of larger picture.
Yes, of course. I mean, I don't read literature in order to sort of, you know, just read the political message or any other message in it. Literature is art. I remember reading a novel by an Israeli writer. I think it was Aharon Appelfeld, the Israeli writer. And it was about a novel about a three Jewish boys who are wandering across Europe during the Nazi assault on Eastern Europe, in Poland, other places. And they're just running from one place to a place, and they're being, you know, and you feel it, like at any time these boys will be arrested and by the Nazis and being sent to Auschwitz or any of the concentration camps. And by the end of it, these boys managed to get on a ship that was going to Palestine. And I remember when I read the ending, I felt a sense of relief that what happened at the end. But then for one second I realized, these people are coming to my country. They are coming to take my country. It was coming to Palestine in the 40s. And that was literature is all about, isn't it? It's, I mean, literature is about this sense of something that changes you, changes your attitude. You discover your humanity. You know, suddenly something larger than a country, larger than a home, larger than the whole idea of national identity. And that to identify with three children, which I could see myself as one of them, you know, wandering in a sort of in a hostile environment, in a hostile country, where just one mistake will lead to your death, and suddenly just wandering and trying to find a place to where they can be safe. And this sense, this comes through reading fiction. This comes through reading a novel. I mean, I've argued against, you know, Jewish immigration to Palestine for ages, and suddenly, all of a sudden, I suddenly realized that, you know, how important for people to come to Palestine, for important for them. Later on, of course, my attitude developed in different ways. But I'm saying that how important for a novel to sort of open up our minds and our sentiments to other people's existence, other people's experience. And yes, that's what helped me to sort of understand and to be aware and to have sense of the Jewish experience in Europe in the first half of the 20th century.
Well, I regret that our time is up. Samir El-Youssef, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Samir El-Youssef co-authored the book Gaza Blues with the Israeli writer Edgar Keret. His essays and reviews have been published in major Arabic periodicals. He spoke to us from London. I'm Terry Gross.